This month's podcast features Professor Rita Smith, a lifelong educator and the 1985 recipient of Time Magazine's Teacher of the Year Award. Professor Smith has been teaching for her entire life, beginning her career at Norwell High School as a history teacher before moving on to Brockton High School, and eventually spent nearly two decades as the chair of the Secondary Education Department, teaching students striving to become teachers themselves at her alma mater Stonehill College before retiring in 2006. In this podcast, you'll hear the most important lesson Professor Smith ever learned as a teacher.
Which to me was the most important lesson that I could have learned as a new teacher, that it's the questions that matter most, not the answers, because answers change.
And about from all the roles she has served in education, only one stood out as having the greatest impact.
What I learned also is that even though I had the political influence, you know, as a chairman of the board and a member of the Down Board of Education, I could do more in a classroom. I could have a greater impact as a teacher.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by maintaining grade-level skills and targeting unfinished learning. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. To say Rita Smith has been a teacher all her life would not tell the full story. She has been an educator, teaching and connecting with people not just in a classroom, but wherever she happens to encounter them. In a recent conversation with JFY's executive director, Gary Kaplan, and myself, Rita began by talking about the strong influence her father had on how to treat all people with dignity and respect.
Okay, well, why don't we plunge into our topic for today, which is you.
I know, that's so embarrassing.
No kidding, isn't it?
It surely is. It surely is. I grew up in Holbrook, which is not very far from Brockton or Randolph. South Shore. And I grew up in a very large family, seven children, and there were six girls and one boy, and he was the youngest. And of course, we've spoiled him rotten. He's a wonderful, wonderful young man today. He's 73 years old. I had sisters, lots of sisters. And my mother was a strong influence on us in terms of education. She just kept saying to us, hey, this is what it's all about, education. She had to quit high school during the Depression, because her family was in trouble. My father had got a full scholarship to BC. He went to Holbrook High School, but he had to turn it down because of, again, the Depression and the need to support his family because his father had had a heart attack. But at any rate, you know, so we were a struggling family, but we were a good family, a family that placed a high priority in education. And my father's number one contribution was equity. He was always so driven by the notion that we're all the same. I mean, he would say things like, even the queen has to go to the bathroom. You know, I mean, the notion that there were differences, significant differences between us, just was absolutely alien to him. And it was also about, you know, making certain that people are not left behind. He used to always say, if the refrigerators on Western Avenue are empty, there will not be any peace in the world, as long as we have a full refrigerator and they don't. But anyway, we grew up there. I graduated from high school. I was in the class of 1958. And I can connect my choice of majors, not majors, little boxes that they put us into, because of the fact that I preferred playing basketball to anything. I was really good at it. In fact, the local, the principal of Holbrook High School, Garland Neal, he lived on Western Avenue, which was the place we always wanted to make sure they had full refrigerators. He told my father to build me a basketball hoop in the backyard. And he did. And I mean, he bought my lunch for me at school, Holbrook High School, every time I got double numbers in a game. You know, every time I got 10 plus points. You know, he was a wonderful man. I mean, it was a good and it was a day long ago, but he had all of the necessary qualities that one would have in an outstanding principal. and community-based. My sister Maureen, when she was getting ready to go to college, she was going to do college, so was Patty, because they were outstanding artists like my mother. I was the athlete. And so at any rate, Maureen was taking algebra, and she always constantly complained about it because she didn't understand it. The concept was beyond her. And somehow, Colin Neal found out. Must have talked to Elena Knutson, because I have her report card, and she did very poorly in algebra. She got like a D, which is saving her from being kicked out onto the, under the bus. So at any rate, Colin Neal showed up at the door at the algebra class, knocked, and said to Elena Knutson, I want to talk to Maureen Smith. Maureen said, this is it? I'm going to, what's happening? Maureen was a nervous person, but at any rate, very talented person. So she came out. Colin Neal said to her, from now on, instead of coming to algebra, you're going to go to the art room. And Mr. Kendallin, who was the art teacher, is going to give you private instructions. And that was it.
In art.
In art. Maureen went on to art. She was an art professor. She built a strong business. I mean, she never stopped talking about Colin Neal, because he had it in him to see differences.
Yeah, and he just excused her from math?
He excused her from math. Which meant he must have had to play with some figures on her transcript.
Oh, you know? Sure.
But I mean, he just knew this is where she belonged. Yeah. I mean, since she entered the Garfield School, which is the one-room schoolhouse on Pleasant Street where we lived, it was Maureen was the artist, and she just knew this is what she was going to do, and that was the only reason she wanted to go to college, so that she could be a professional artist, and he made it possible. He made it possible.
Where did she go to college?
She went to the Boston Art Institute of Boston. It's got another name.
Yeah.
Affiliated with Lesley University or something like that.
Right.
It's a great place. It didn't give out degrees, by the way, in those days. So that he probably didn't have to phony up the figures because they didn't get degrees. Later on, they affiliated with some university and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they give it out. But no, she was an incredible. My sister Patty, too. My sister Patty went to that same school. Mm-hmm. My mother, this is what my mother did when my father died. My mother was never able to graduate high school because of the Depression. My sister Maureen was teaching at the Art Institute of Boston. She went to the guy in charge. She said, I'd like to bring my mother here. And he said, I'd love to meet your mother. And she came and she went to school there for 2 years. She was this elderly woman amongst all these wild and crazy college kids. Here she was being their mother at the same time, too, in college.
Oh, wow.
And she never graduated from high school. People could do things, but he never let them, quote, prevent someone from spreading their wings and soaring. Yeah. And that's what Colin Neal did for my family and for me. I was just about to graduate
from high school.
18.
I was about 18.
It was second semester. It was April. And it was a tradition. I was in the commercial club, or the commercial course. Back in those days, women had very few options. You know, we could be a teacher, a nurse, a secretary, or a social worker. I wanted to play basketball. And so my route was going to be do this commercial stuff. And then, you know, who knows? But at any rate, I went to this on this field trip to the John Hancock building, because they were going to introduce all of us. And the bus was full, because this is all that girls did in those days, in the 50s. Sure. We were to go to the John Hancock and see our future. Well, we rode on the bus and we sang 45 bottles of wine. Did you ever sing that song? Oh, we did all the time. We just loved to sing songs.
I remember that.
Right on a bus, because ours were like, you could walk to school. So that was the extra thrill to be on the big yellow bus. So we got there and we were able to miraculously, and it wasn't a miracle then, it was just not the norm. We parked right in front of the old John Hancock building.
On Berkeley Street.
On Berkeley Street. So anyway, I'm the president, step off the bus with Anna Damon. She was my teacher. And we stepped out into the office and into the entrance to the building. And of course, we're oohing and ahhing all over the place. And then the next thing you know, we were given our first ride on an elevator. I mean, this tells you.
That's your first ride.
First ride in an elevator. We lived in Holbrook. You know, but again, you got to emphasize, that was in my lifetime, and I'm still here. Do you know what I mean? And so that tells you, like, change does take place. You know, sometimes we don't even see it. We're so busy angry, you know. But at any rate, I got on the elevator. Everybody's talking about the ears popping. And we went up and up and up and up. And then the doors just opened, and I saw my future. World's largest typing pool. Mm-hmm. And those manual typewriters. And all these women were sitting there with their shoulders back, and they had red lipstick on, and they had red fingernail polish on, and they were just pounding away on these manual typewriters. I said to myself, oh my God, what have I done? This is not where I'm going to come. So I got on the bus. I didn't cry there, but when I went home, I cried, but to my mother. I said, Ma, if you send me there, I'm going to die. I will die. I will absolutely die. They had a little room where it's like a size of a closet where the women could go in and smoke, because smoking was in those days.
Oh,
and it was full of smoke, and it was just butts of cigarettes with red lipstick on them, and they were all crushed out because they had to get back to their typewriter. So when I got home, I said to my mother, Ma, please don't send me there because I'll die. Well, God love my mother, even though the Irish Catholics didn't accept her. My father, being Irish and Catholic, had lots and lots of Catholic priests because they were Irish in the family. It was their only way to get ahead. And so at any rate, my mother called this priest who was my father's cousin. He called Cardinal Cushing. He had a school named after him in Brookline. It was called Cardinal Cushing College. And they had a program there where they would prepare women, of course, because it was just all women, to be teachers of shorthand and typing, at, you know, the subjects that I could do. And I would have a degree so that I could teach, but I would only be teaching, you know, these things because they were thinking that this was going to go on and on and on, that this is where women were always going to be, you know, always going to be. They were never going to be able to be in the mainstream. I mean, this is my lifetime. This is my lifetime.
And we're talking about 1958, 59.
1958, 59. Yeah. 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 So at any rate, I went to that school and I was there for about a year, and, but then they closed down. And so now where does Rita go? So my mother gets in the car. She had finally got her driver's license, which was not something most women got then.
No. But at what age did she get her driver's license?
She had to be in what I was 18. So she had to be in her 40s, somewhere in her 40s. But it was an unusual thing. And she had seven kids. And all she had was a little red wagon that she could go uptown to the AMP and buy the food and bring it home. Kids would have to get out of the wagon while she carried the food home. You know, so she didn't drive. But at this point in her life, she had gone up and got a driver's license. So she drove me over to Stonehill College. And Stonehill had to change. See, because that's what it's about. It's the have to change, the have to change. Mm-hmm. We have to see it, and it has to touch us personally.
Why did Stonehill have to change?
Well, they had been an all-male school.
Right.
And now the Korean War wiped out a lot of those young men.
Right.
You know, and so they had to take in women. They had to take us in. They had
to fill the seats.
Yeah, that's right. The first woman that was invited, that was just, she's always in every Stonehill College photograph. And they never lose sight of that. And they want people to know that history. The first woman was Brenda Monsey, who became my good friend, her older sister, Elise Monsey. And she was the very first woman accepted into Stonehill College. And she was the only woman there. But at any rate, by the time I was 58, and they still had empty seats. And so they took me in. I just was able to go forward with my sophomore year, junior year, senior year, and graduate from Stonehill College.
In what, 62?
In 62, yeah. And the thing that always impressed me, and this is not saying I was impressed with myself, by no means, but that when I was in high school, because I was a commercial person, commercial, you know, track, the damn tracks, I was not able to go to the library. They didn't give us library passes. Why would somebody in the commercial course go to the library? I mean, they can read, but all we did was write bread and butter letters. We would spend an entire class about how to fold a letter perfectly so that you could send it out as a secretary. And the name of the man at the bottom of it, because of course it's a man, you know, would represent himself quite well. You know, we just were limited. You know, we didn't read Shakespeare. We didn't read anything that was beyond, short stories. We had a collection of short stories. That's about all. And bread and butter letters. That's what we would write. But at any rate, they were setting me up for that future. they thought they were doing the right thing, just like we do too, you know, but we're not always right. We're not always right. And so at any rate, I ended up becoming a college professor, even though I never took the college course. My sister Maureen became a highly successful businesswoman and artist, even mm-hmm. though she took algebra. And that said to me, these boxes, they're just, they're cruel little cells. And it's not so much they don't have the on the paper credentials, because you can find your ways around it. I've always pretty much lived my life back door. I love back doors. I always look for the back door. You know, there's, and I teach my students that when I was at Stonehill, back door, back door. You know, front door, there's some problems there. You know, maybe the receptionist isn't going to be friendly to you, but if you come in the back door, it's the best way to get into someplace and do what is, would do what you want. So at any rate, no, I was proud of that. And I would emphasize that with my students, you know, because they, when I was teaching at Stonehill, they had all gone through the college course. You know, they took all those classes that I never took.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now here they were in college and they're worrying about their future and what am I going to be when I grow up and how can mm-hmm. I do it? Da-da-da-da-da-da. And I'd say to them, hey, listen, I took the commercial course. They didn't know what I meant by that. Mm-hmm. I didn't take the college course, mm-hmm. but I'm a college professor and you can do the same. Go for the back door.
Before you got to Stonehill, you were at Brockton. And then before that, you were at Holbrook, right? You taught, oh no, Norwell.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Norwell. Yeah. I did taught there. Yeah. My history.
And it was in Norwell that you encountered the student that talked about the Pilgrims.
John Stilgo. I got to go to Norwell to teach when I graduated. And again, it was a back door. The superintendent of Scituate was a cousin of my father's Irish cousins. And I'm graduating college and I need a job. So my mother called friend, I shouldn't probably use the names, but he was the superintendent, and told him that Rita was looking for a job. Lo and behold, again, bingo, I got a job teaching at Norwell High School. I didn't stay there very long. Yeah, I didn't stay very long, but I got into the teaching there. And I learned my most important lesson in my first year of teaching. And it was on one day I was teaching and I was doing what I'm doing right now, just rambling on about all kinds of things, talking and every now and then put something down on the blackboard, you know, and these little people are sitting there quiet, you know, doing what they're told. And there was one kid, he just didn't do what everyone else did. They just sort of sat silently and listened and every now and then pretend to take a note. His hand would go up. He'd shoot his hand up. And as soon as his hand went up, my blood pressure, it just went up so high. I'm surprised I didn't have a stroke, because this was a kid that I knew was smarter than me. And I said, Jesus, I'm supposed to have all the answers, because I believe teachers had the answers. That was my mistake. That was my mistake. John taught me an important lesson, that it's the questions that are more important than the answers. He asked me a question, and I'm giving him an award for this. He doesn't know about that, but I've sculpted for him a piece of artwork. It's a relief of the inside of an Egyptian pyramid, and it's got an Egyptian figure on it. But then also I have Khan, Maze. John read the same chapter that I did, but I read it 5 times. John looked at it, probably skimmed through it, and he saw that photograph, and he saw inside of an Egyptian pyramid.
Yeah.
And it was on the wall.
Yeah.
His question, why were the Pilgrims so surprised when the Native American Indians introduced them to Khan? And I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, Jesus, John, I don't know what you're talking about. We're in the Crusades right now. We're doing the Crusades. Well, John demonstrated his superior intelligence, but at the same time too, what he did is he said, but the Europeans, when they went to the Middle East through the Crusades, they got spices, they got silks, they got fabrics, they should have got corn, and they should have known about it. And I went like, my God, the bell rang and I was so relieved, you know, and I ran like hell out of there. But that's John. He went on to become a full professor at Harvard. He's been there over 20 years. He's written all kinds of books, you know. I mean, he's just a very brilliant young man. And well, he's not young anymore either. He's 73. But I'm hoping to get together with him. I mean, I've every now and then I've bumped into him, you know, like at a class reunion. They had a reunion because we buried a time capsule we were going to take up at their 25th reunion or something like that. Mm. And so John was there and I was there. I went right up to John and I said, John, I have the answer to the question. And he said, so? He always used to put his hand on his chin like this. You know, he's just such a kid, man. He's just so smart. And I said, so I told him my answer. And he said, not bad, but not good enough. That question to this day hasn't been answered. It hasn't been answered.
Why the Crusaders didn't bring back corn?
Why were they surprised? There it was. Because there are some people that believe that corn originated in Egypt. Think about that. We've always had it, Mexico. And that's where most of, you know, the anthropologists and all the other serious historians have credited them. But there's a large group that says, no, Egypt. It was in Egypt first. And they still haven't come to an agreement, which to me was the most important lesson that I could have learned as a new teacher, that it's the questions that matter most, not the answers, because answers change.
Let me also ask, so then you get to Brockton High School. You were very lucky to have an administrator that pretty much just gave you kind of free rein.
And it
led to you being named, I think it was 1985, Time Magazine Teacher of the Year.
Yeah, that was quite a surprise to me and my students as well. I still don't think it was me. I always felt that it was I would always say, like, it was my department chair, John Salvucci, who recommended me. And my students looked and said, her? Her? See, because kids keep you humble. You can never get to that place where you think you know everything. Because you don't. You know, and they're going to always, always remind you. And they're also very forgiving. Adults aren't. My problem is, and this is like maybe psychological, maybe I should see somebody and talk about it. I don't like adults. I love kids. Because kids you can work with. You can one day be in a nasty mood and snap at some kid, and they're going to forgive you. It's all gone. Next day, they're sitting in class again, running. So what, do you want me to run an errand? They love to run errands. You know, I mean, kids are willing to take on impossible things. Like, that was largely what I used to tempt them with. I was teaching European history. So I said, we need a stage. So what we did is we had, as a team, everyone in that class, and I had five classes of that, we were involved in painting a map of Western Europe, full color to scale, on the floor of our classroom. So that became our stage. But see, what that became for the kids was, now what are we going to do next year? Because Brockton High, we had 5,300 kids there, 50 different languages. But, you know, kids, they just, if they're doing something and they're loving it, it never worked very well for me with other teachers. Because, not to say all other teachers, not certainly true, but they would say, well, why can't we do what we do in Rita Smith's class? You know, and there were a lot of teachers too who still felt that it's just the answer that's the important thing. And they just didn't know, you know, a plus to have that experience. But, it, you know, and as a team working together, Michael, he was a kid from a trade school. He didn't even just in the law, he came from the school, the trade school. And because they didn't want him, sent him over to Brockton High. He's in my class and he could be a pain sometimes. And so I said, after school today, Michael came after school when these three young men who were my top students, they went on to become doctors and lawyers and all the rest of it. They were sitting there with, because we had calculators then and all these other little primitive toys. And they were trying to figure out how to do the, this is critical thinking, how to figure out the scale, because we wanted to make this map to scale. And so Michael, who was a shot kid, leather jacket, was after school with me. He wanders over, stands over them. They're on the floor on the calculators and stuff. And these people had never talked before. I mean, because they were in separate worlds. They were in separate classes. And so at any rate, Michael looked down and he said, what are you doing? And of course they were silent at first. They were petrified. And then the next thing you know, they said to him what the problem was, trying to figure out the scale. And he just looked at them and he said, that's no problem. He said, look at the floor. And they're thinking he's going to put them down on the floor, face first. And he said, you got a natural grid system. Think about that.
Tiles.
Is that brilliant? How brilliant is that? Michael rose to the occasion. He told them it was simple. And that's what they did. And one of them, Lewis, I won't give you his last name, who became a physician, and he's in, I think he's at, you know, because I bumped into him once. He was at, a hospital in Boston, Brigham and Women's. He got into Harvard, mm-hmm. full scholarship, mm-hmm. on an essay, which was the story of Michael. Michael, who taught them, who showed them, like just like Michael, just like John Stilgoe did with me. You know, and it's like just every time that would happen, you know, you just take a deep breath and you say to yourself, whew, and you know, you just can't get enough of it. You can't get enough. But anyway, Lewis got into Harvard on that activity. We went on to do other things. We did a maze. We started in the parking lot with a maze because the parking lot seems safe because they don't trust kids more often than not. They think they're going to make a mess. Yeah. And that is going to be the big issue. In fact, when we were getting ready to paint the floor, you know, in my classroom, Chris Argus, who was my principal, and he was not principal, but he was a headmaster, and he was like a gallant. And he just said, I called me on the weekend and he said, Rita, he said, you've already bought the paint. And I said, no, I haven't. I'm going to do that next week. And he said, you have already bought the paint. And he repeated it 3 times. And so finally I got the message. And so I said, thank you. I mean, this is, he would make sure, because he'd always say, first and foremost, we're here to have a good time and we're going to have fun. Mm-hmm. And so just totally supported me in whatever I did. It got so bad because we did a lot of things. We did parking lots. We did living chess tournaments. And we just did so many things. That's why a lot of attention was brought to me, but it was my students. You know, we did all those projects. And in the end, as far as I'm concerned, it was their hard work and their willingness to do it. Do you know what I mean? Their willingness to do it. Because everybody else, it's impossible. You can't do that. They won't let you. I mean, imagine you're only 15 years old and already you've learned that they're not going to let you. So I say to myself, anytime a kid would say that, we're doing it. They live to be 55 or 65 or our age. Good God. Imagine how boring they would be. They'll just be sitting in a corner barking at people, you know. And so at any rate, you know, we did a lot of collaborative projects. The Living Chess Tournament was great. We did it first at Brockton High to raise money for a scholarship for a colleague who had died. But then we were invited to do it at the National Council for the Social Studies Conference in Boston. So we were at the Sheraton. We had chandeliers on the ceiling. And all these kids they had to choose a particular historical or literary character from French history or from English history. And then they had to research the character. Then they had to make the costume and they had to look at paintings and they had to do it, you know, according to history. We then put all of these characters on a gigantic chessboard and then we were to move them around. My students, and this to this day, I just don't know how they did it. They wrote the script. See, I always knew, John taught me that. I didn't know everything. And if you can look to your students, it was like when we were doing the maze in the parking lot, the medieval maze. I mean, Michael introduced them to a plumb line. Well, they had never before done it. Everybody was plumb lining all over the place. The chalk, boom, down it would go. And some of the markings weren't correct, so we had to change them, and then we had to start over again. But at any rate, no, my students, they did all that work because they believed. And I felt that was always, and I still feel that my job as a teacher is to be a mirror. They're going to look at me self as I see them. And they're going to believe in themselves. They're going to know they can do it. Billy, well, I'm not going to give you his last name, but when we were doing the chess game, Billy always had a stutter. Billy couldn't speak too much without the words coming out wrong, like President Biden. Billy was chosen by his chess mates, best actor, 2 years in a row. He had a shining moment, sometimes a shining moment.
Yeah.
But these projects were that we did. I mean, believe me, I was right down. I was keeping them filled with information. We did Copernicus, do the ceiling solar system. Why not do Copernicus up here and do it with fluorescent paint? And so you can strobe lights on. Yeah. And then I played classical music and they would stand up there in front of the strobe light, which was behind the which where they were in front of a screen, and these crazy shadows would be coming. You know, I mean, this was not, I wasn't crazy in the sense that I wasn't, I was neglecting the academics. But see, to me, if you're going to foster creativity, critical thinking, collaboration, you know, communication, what I call the six C's, you do it with your methodology. And a lot of it's John Dewey anyway, it's experiential. But and again, if you're on a team, like I would never just have my advanced kids here doing it and then my basic kids over here cleaning up afterwards. I had them always working together. So I take on a lot of kids, like about 150 of them. With 150 different kids, they learn very quickly that together they can do anything. And they too can contribute, that everyone can contribute.
Well, no, this is actually very pertinent. You're talking about within alcohol, project-based learning. I think the field as a whole has just recently discovered project-based learning.
Oh my God! Yeah.
It's one of the latest great new ideas. But I don't know that, you know, what you just said, that you combine students of different skill levels. You don't. It's not all the top kids or all the bottom kids. You put them all together, and then they can work together and they can all learn from each other. I don't know if that point of view is active in the discussions of project-based learning now. It's something we should pay some attention to that. If that is what they're talking about.
I love teachers. I respect teachers. I admire teachers. I am a teacher. That's really all I've ever been. And I love teaching. You know, but at the same time too, you know, some of them are still living in the depth in the past. You know, that it's like each kid lined up alphabetically, like John Stilgo. He sat in the back left-hand row because his name was Stilgo. That's where I used to sit. My name was Smith. Do you know what I mean? I stopped doing that. I stopped. And my whole approach to teaching changed because of John Stilgo. And then I could reinforce it again and again and again, you know. I was really driven largely by my father. Can we all go to the bathroom? You know, I mean, you just can't box people up, because I had also been boxed up and I didn't even know I was boxed up when I was doing the commercial course. I was busy playing basketball, you know, and those kids, it's the same. It's the same. You know, I feel very strongly. That's what most of my career was about.
Breaking out of boxes.
Breaking out of boxes, getting kids to break out of boxes. I remember when I was at Stonehill, which was really fun too, because I taught at Stonehill. Again, these kids are in college now, so they're sophisticated. And, you know, they don't play anymore. And so I like to play, and I never gave it up. And so I taught a course called Common Ground. It was a general studies class. And my principal reason for doing Common Ground was because of the fact that these kids were going to be teachers. And the world had changed, even though their personal worlds hadn't changed. Their mothers and grandmothers' worlds had changed because they had fled Boston during busing. And they went into the suburbs, like Scituate is, whether they call it South Boston with trees. You know, so they got out of town as fast as they could. And these kids grew up in very white worlds. They grew up in Nauvoo, you know, and so they came, you know, to Stonehill. You know, Stonehill now is a very, very diverse school. It's advanced. Again, change happens. Change can happen. It's not a reason to ever quit and give up. But at any rate, they were going to be teachers. And so I established another program. So because, again, it's that whole experiential thing, John Dewey. I established a program at the Messiah Baptist Church in Brockton, which was downtown Brockton. And most people in the suburbs didn't even go to Brockton because they think, oh, my God, they're going to be just looted and plundered and they're going to die. So I brought those kids. And many of them had come out of Catholic schools, and they were coming to Stonehill, and it was a very safe place. It's a beautiful, beautiful campus. It's like in the suburbs, you know, it's got trees all around it. You know, everything is safe, you know. But at any rate, I set up a program called the Wednesday Academic Club for Kids. And it was students of mine that set it up. She called it WAC, Wednesday Academic Club for Kids. And we would go there every Wednesday. I would always go because I knew their parents would be uncomfortable. So I would go. And then also, Francis Pina, who had been a student of mine at Brockton High School, going way back to the days before even the new high school was built. Her husband was a police officer, and she went to the Messiah Baptist Church. So she was the one who encouraged me. She wanted me to go to that church and do something with the kids. So they opened the church up to us. And so Frances and her husband would come every Wednesday night as well. We did field trips. We got scholarships. We got grants, I mean, through the college, you know, and we were able to provide for those kids these opportunities. But for my students, it provided them with the opportunity to discover the commonality of humans, you know, that these kids are all the same. You know, they may have different backgrounds, different incomes, they may have different races, but they are one in the same and deserving of respect and equal opportunities.
Which is something that your father had been saying back in the 30s.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and that again is I think part of the mistake that we make in not just in education, but especially in education, is when we track kids, stick them in boxes, we just cause them to just think less of themselves or maybe a little too much about themselves. And so, I mean, especially in a country like ours, you know, how we talk about, well, we're divided. It's no surprise, you know, from the time they enter school, you know, everybody's broken down into little groups. They don't do it as much anymore. Now they've opened up. And they have the curriculum frameworks, which are wonderful.
That was going on in the 1990s. What were you doing at that time?
I was teaching. I was at Stonehill. I was teaching at Stonehill. So, and I was very troubled by that.
You were?
Because I had the privilege of being able to decide on my own curriculum. I could get my own textbooks. I was into, you know, critical thinking in the 70s. And every teacher was a teacher of reading, and every teacher was a teacher of writing, you know. And so we had those movements. Things were breaking. Things were starting to break. But at the same time, too, the tracks were still there. And so that became my mission, you know. But since then, schools have detracted. But they still pigeonhole kids. And they're in boxes, and they don't think well of themselves, and they don't think they're capable of this or capable of that. But the curriculum framework, see this, I read this morning in the Washington Post, and you should read it. It's the new curriculum frameworks for social studies. Now, when the curriculum frameworks first came out in the 90s, I said, oh my God, my poor kids are gonna have to know all these things. And then I'm at the college and I have to try to get the history department to do this because it's on the frameworks. And then the teacher test is gonna test them for geography and they don't offer geography, you know? And so it was a challenge, but I did what I had to do to make it work for the kids so that they could get their credentials and go on and teach. But at the same time too, I was troubled by a lot of that because when I was a teacher, my grades counted. If I gave a kid an A, it really was an A. If I failed a kid, they really did fail. Do you know what I mean? And now their whole life, their whole future depends on that test score. And it just didn't make sense to me. And I'm thinking about the Michaels of the world, you know, Billy's of the world. You know, how are they going to handle this? You know, I still don't know how they handle it. I still don't know how they handle it because, you know, it's just... If you've taken the college course, you're going to do okay.
Yeah.
But if you haven't, you're still going to be in trouble. You're still going to be in trouble. But the new frameworks for social studies, I love them. Mm. I just couldn't believe that I found myself saying that this morning. And I said to myself, I'm so glad it happened to me today because then I'm relevant. I can talk about the frameworks. Because I kept saying, I'm just talking about the olden days. I'm talking about when I was teaching. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was so long ago. And I'm thinking, like, why? What's the purpose here now? What's the benefit? Why should anyone listen to me, you know? But I'm telling you now, they're revised. And they include much of what I was not introduced to when I was learning to become a teacher. We didn't do anything with, I was a history major. Now, wouldn't you think I'd know about June 19th. I just learned about that. I just learned about that. Tulsa, Oklahoma, did I know about that? Nobody ever taught me that. And I mean, now granted, I've read a hell of a lot of books, but I was shocked. This entire community, a Wall Street, and it's burnt to the ground, you know? And I didn't know about that. I just learned that Rhode Island was a slave state. But I mean, I'm not blaming the people that wrote the textbooks, but the things is about the curriculum frameworks. If the textbooks are aligned with the curriculum frameworks, then there's a better chance that kids all over this country, regardless of whether they live in the South or they live in the West or they live in New England, not that, and the same story is going to be more complete.
So I want to ask a question. If you had to do it all over again, would you travel the same path that brought you to where you are today?
In a New York minute. And I mean, I'm embarrassed to say, you know, that I'm obsolete. I mean, I'm not really fully obsolete, but at the same time too, that's the past. But over the course of the years that I've been in this business, and especially now with technology, there have been so many more advancements. I mean, my job at Stonehill, I had to set up a teacher education program for the secondary students. And my goal, because of my father, you know, everyone's the same. I established, you know, a program, a teacher education program that promoted, you know, equity and, you know, people working together and respecting one another. And so I was able to, through that common ground, you took common ground. I was able to do it through common ground to prepare them, but also to, in many ways, enlighten them about things, like, because they didn't know those histories either. And it was in their own family. It was their grandmother and their grandfather that fled South Boston to come to Scituate. And they didn't even know why. But so now they were learning.
So you would do it all over again.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You still
wouldn't go into that typing pool at Hancock.
Oh, no, I wouldn't go into the typing pool. No, no, I was able to, because of the people that I worked with, like Chris August, you know, I could do things. No, and that was, to me, the beauty of, the other thing I did is I ran for a school committee in my town of Holbrook. Selected. And I was the chair. Two stories on that during the blizzard of 78, which I can't wait to come back here because we need students in my neighborhood, kids in my neighborhood knew that I was the chair of the school board and I had the authority to call school off. So whenever there was a storm, they brought buckets and buckets of snow and piled it up in my driveway, piled it up in my sidewalk, you know, because they'd keep me locked up because I couldn't get up. But I always thought by going into that position, they're so good, they're so fun, they just do it, they're honest, you know. But what I learned also is that even though I had the political influence, you know, as a chairman of the board and a member of the Stown Board of Education, I could do more in the classroom. I could have a greater impact as a teacher.
Oh, really?
Oh my God, yes, on the world. Because if I change one kid, if I open up, then they are, you know, and they're enlightened in the way that John enlightened me. I've changed the world. But in boards of education, we had a good time. You wouldn't believe how much money I put into the field trip account. You know, every time the budget came to me, I put a lot of money into that field trip account because that's, to me, again, how they're going to find out. They're going to have to see it, feel it, experience it. But no, I would do it. There are so many more possibilities today, but I would encourage a lot of those women and those men to enter education. Not all of them, but just those that love kids and want to make a difference in their lives and in their community. You know, you can make, it sounds like a Hallmark card, but it's true. It's true. I'm a part of that. If it hadn't been for Ellen and, you know, Anna Damon organizing that field trip to take us to Boston, you know, where would I be today? Do you know what I mean? Where would I be today? I wouldn't be here. But the bottom line is I love teaching. Jane Stalling, she's an educational researcher, very brilliant woman, lots and lots of articles. Her son bought a restaurant. She did a training program for the waitresses in the health. Guess whose program I adopted in my teacher education program? Jane Stalling. I said, if you have a question to ask or you want to interact with that kid in the back of the building, in back of the room, you can't even really see him. He's way back there. You're not going to stand behind a podium and shout out, "What's your name?" You know, I mean, you go to him, like the waitress goes to them, many times, and you anticipate and you know. I did a lot of that. And all my students, most of them, they wait a table. And so all I'd have to say, because it's a relationship, it's a connection, a human connection. You got an opportunity, you can just be a constant Lerna. You know, I now know more history than I knew when I was teaching history because I was relying on textbooks. So I know if in the 21st century I started teaching again, wouldn't use textbooks. I used Edward Fenton. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Edward Fenton had Western civilization and he had concepts. He worked concepts, the characteristics of Western civilization, like nationalism. And when we did nationalism, we did World War II. You know, I mean, so I could step out of the box. I could step out of the box of the textbooks, and I wouldn't really even deal with textbooks except to critique them, you know, with my students today.
Well, I think we have covered a lot of good ground today. We could go on for another 3 or 4 hours. Well, Rita, again, this has been really fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. You've really...
patiently listening, because it's a lot of stuff, but right. I loved what I did, you know.
Well, yes, obviously.
Yeah, but I want to thank you for your commitment to education and what you're doing. You told me a little bit about the different programs that you have, skill development, and how it gives to teachers those opportunities to diversify within their class. Whereas when I used to try to get my students to come up with different strategies for different kids, it's asking too much.
Rita, thank you.
We would like to thank Professor Rita Smith for joining us this month on the JFY Networks podcast. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources, including this monthly podcast, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.